Case number 18-1219 et al. Advanced Gear Foods, Inc. Petitioner v. National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Lincoln for the petitioner, Mr. Hickman, the respondent.
Mr. Lindstrom, good morning.
Good morning, Aaron.
Can you sort of step away from the receiver? Mr. Lindstrom, can you just say something so?
Yes, Your Honor. Can you hear me now?
No, I. It's all garbled. Are you on a speakerphone?
I am not on a speakerphone, Your Honor.
Okay, well, that's better. All right. Would you please proceed with your opening statement then?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Aaron Lindstrom, on behalf of Advanced Pure Foods, I've asked to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. There are two issues this morning, the board's imposition of a read-aloud remedy and the board's treatment of non-coercive speech as an unfair labor practice. On the first, the board imposed an extraordinary remedy without explaining why traditional remedies would be insufficient. That approach is not just an abuse of discretion, it's also arbitrary and capricious under State Farm, which requires that agencies do not fail to consider an important aspect of the problem.
That's an attack on the reasoning of the board, correct?
Yes, it's a failure to explain.
But you never presented to the board the claim that the order on which you seek review was inadequately reasoned.
Yes, Your Honor. There was no motion for reconsideration. But our argument here is that when an agency is acting in excess of its authority, as the U.S. Supreme Court explained in Detroit Edison, then in that instance, 160E is no bar to this court considering it. And when an agency acts arbitrary and capriciously, that is a violation of its statutory authority. It violates the APA, and therefore it's in excess. And I think the City of Arlington case shows that there's no distinction between some jurisdictional statutory limitations and other statutory limitations that might be thought to be non-jurisdictional for agencies. All limits on statutory authority are limits that mean the agency is acting ultra vires, to use the Supreme Court's words in City of Arlington, when it exceeds those limits. And I think in this case, it's also something that's important that it's not just us invoking the court's jurisdiction. This is also a case where the board is asking this court to enforce the order. And so this court needs to determine, as the U.S. Supreme Court explained in NLRB versus Cheney Lumber, needs to consider whether the order that this court would be enforcing is a lawful order or not. So in this case, I think both the merits of the arbitrary and capricious argument about the read-aloud remedy and the jurisdictional point, they both overlap and are the same point, essentially, that when an agency fails to consider a key factor, that means it's acting arbitrarily and capriciously, and so that means it's acting outside of statutory authority, and it's ultra vires. And therefore, it's both an abuse of discretion and something that this court has jurisdiction to consider.
Doesn't that make any kind of garden variety, arbitrary and capricious argument then outside the ambit of Section 10E if we were to accept your argument? And doesn't that, in effect, really undermine Congress's intent when it drafted Section 10E?
I don't think it undermines Congress's intent, Your Honor. It would still preclude parties from raising arguments they hadn't object to. They go to lots of other issues, questions of fact, applying standards to facts, applying judicial precedents. But I think Congress would have thought that it's an extraordinary circumstance, for example, if an agency is acting outside its statutory authority. And
why are those any less fundamental I mean, on your reasoning, just as an agency lacks authority to enforce an unreasoned decision, it also lacks authority to enforce a decision that is unsupported by substantial evidence, which is all fact questions.
I think, Your Honor, that the difference is there may be some questions of fact that go beyond the substantial evidence. There may be other issues that where there's still a question of fact that's in dispute. I guess I have to acknowledge that this is an argument that it takes statutory limits like those found in the APA seriously, that those are limits that Congress imposed on all agencies. And when an agency, I mean, I think that's what City of Arlington says very clearly, that whenever an agency steps beyond the bounds of its authority, whether both in how it's acting and in its authority to act, it's essentially the same question. And so in both instances, they're acting ultra vires. So, for example, in the City of Arlington, they said, the U.S. Supreme Court said, both an agency's power to act and how they act is authoritatively prescribed by Congress, so that when they act improperly, no less than when they act beyond their jurisdiction, what they do is ultra vires. The court also said that there's no difference insofar as the validity of agency action is concerned between an agency's exceeding the scope of its authority, its jurisdiction, and its exceeding authorized application of authority that it unquestionably has. So both the application of authority and the things you might think of as jurisdictional, in both instances, it goes to the agency's power to act because they're different from courts. They don't have power under the Constitution. All of their power comes from the statutes that govern them.
Suppose I disagree with you on preservation of the claim that the order was unreasoned. Is there any other argument you have with regard to the remedy?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think
there's the second strand of argument you make that the board abused its discretion, and I can't quite tell whether that's a freestanding argument about the evidence, which might be preserved, or sometimes you articulate it as just an argument for reversal without remand, assuming that the explanation is no good.
So I think even if you disagree with me about this preservation issue, we could still prevail on that second part, that it's abuse of discretion on these facts where there's no high-level manager involved, there's no history, the acts are the violations were not egregious, and then the fact that they didn't provide any persuasive explanation for what the traditional, why traditional remedies would be insufficient. So I think I tied them together because I think the first point is important as well, but there is a separate argument, abuse of discretion, just considering this as a whole on the facts of this case, that it wasn't warranted.
The board says that you should be foreclosed from arguing that Ramirez was not a high-level manager because you did not make that argument anywhere in your exceptions or responses to the general counsel's exceptions below. What's your response to that?
Our response to that, Your Honor, is that that's kind of going beyond what this court has required to preserve an issue. To preserve an issue, it just has to put the board on notice. And when we put the board on notice that we're challenging the remedy because the factors don't total up to it, that puts them on notice that we're going to be arguing about the individual factors, I think. This court has said that it's 160 is not supposed to be requiring a hyper-refinement of the issues, and that when it's something that's implied, necessarily implied within the arguments that are made, then that's sufficient. And I think an argument about one sub-factor is necessarily implied when we're challenging the result of combining those factors as a whole.
So if there's a if there's a five-factor test and you file exceptions that say that, you know, these facts don't meet the standard of the test without articulating which, if any, of the five factors aren't met, you believe that's sufficient to allow you to later challenge any of the five factors as being present if the board finds all of them to be present in their decision and there's no motion for reconsideration that's filed.
I think, Your Honor, I guess yes. I mean, it's a totality of the circumstances type analysis. And here, I mean, in one, well, can I continue to respond, Your Honor?
Thank you. Ahead, yes.
Thank you. And in particular here, in particular where the ALJ specifically said that she distinguished her from upper management by saying that she had to report to upper management, I think that is another reason that it's something that was fair to bring up now. I don't know if I've lost my rebuttal time or if I can turn to the 158C issue.
All right, but you're over your time, so can you do it quickly?
I guess for 158C, I just think I'd like to point out the board has not made any statutory interpretation response to the fact that the statement itself must contain the threat, and they're pointing purely at...
Could we start with preservation? Where did you make that argument to the agency? That's a frontal attack on the Mohawk framework. The way you articulated the point before the agency was that the Mohawk test wasn't met because the ULPs were less pervasive and so on.
So, Your Honor, at JA 571 and 572 is where we made our arguments in the answering brief, where we cited the statute and said that the employer's speech was protected. So, for example, we said that all of the speech was fully permissible under the Act and solidly within Section 8C and Gesell packing. We referred to the fact that the communications didn't contain a threat or a promise. We noted
right.
That employers have a right.
You cited 8C for the uncontested proposition that speech is protected if it's not misleading, but you didn't really engage on this crucial point about whether you assess the threatening nature of the speech within the four corners of the speech or whether you can make neutral speech threatening just by reference to other ULPs.
Well, Your Honor, I think going back to what Section 160E says in our obligation is to present an objection to the board, and it seems to me that by saying the board is violating a statute, that is presenting in the specific statute 158C to protect the employer's right to speech, and that's the binding law, not the board precedent. And so we're relying on the statute that Congress wrote that grants us our rights and protects our rights. So the fact that the board put a gloss on it, I don't think that means we didn't preserve our argument that the statute is what matters and has to be followed. It's a necessary part of the analysis to look at what the statute says. And if the board precedent has departed. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, if there are no more questions, then Mr. Lindstrom, we'll give you a couple minutes in reply. Mr. Hickson.
Thank you.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Michael Hickson for the NLRB. Substantial evidence supports the sole disputed finding of a violation here, and the Board acted well within its broad remedial discretion in ordering a notice reading to remedy that violation, as well as the 16 additional violations that are undisputed before the court. I guess I would turn to the Section 10E issues that have been discussed as they've been a focus of conversation thus far. In terms of the company's attack on the sufficiency of the board's explanation, the company concedes that it did not raise that argument before the board. It says in its reply brief that its failure should be excused. Because it knew when it filed its opening brief that it had not raised this argument to the board, it should have made this excuse contention in its opening brief. Since it waited till the reply, we've not had a chance to respond, but the argument is meritless, we maintain. This court, in fact, has consistently held many times in reviewing NLRB orders specifically that employers' arguments that the board failed to adequately explain a remedy or failed to consider a factor in ordering a remedy are jurisdictionally barred by Section 10E because the employer never raised those arguments before the board. Looking just at the cases that are included in our brief, some of them are cited for this point, some are not, but for example, the Veritas decision, the Pacific Coast Supply decision, the Fallbrook Hospital decision, the Parkwood Developmental Center decision, and the Traction Wholesale decision are all examples of cases where this court has rejected as jurisdictionally barred arguments that the board failed to explain a remedy or failed to consider a factor in determining a remedy.
That seems right to me, but what about the second strand of their argument that just focuses on, they just say, regardless of the explanation, they say it would not be defensible to impose that remedy on this record, which is essentially the point they did make to the board. Why can't they make that argument here?
Your Honor, we did not contend in our brief that they are jurisdictionally barred from arguing that the record does not warrant the remedy. Honestly, I could see that argument because the board did find additional violations that the judge did not find, and the board also relied in ordering the remedy on Ms. Ramirez's high level of status and her pervasive involvement in the ULPs, which the judge also did not consider in making the recommendation against the remedy. So I could see an argument that because of that, that they're also jurisdictionally barred on that strain, although we did not pursue that argument in our brief to the court. But, I mean, our position is that the board simply did not abuse what this court has recognized as its extraordinarily wide discretion in finding that the violations were sufficiently serious and widespread to merit a notice reading. Did someone ask me a question?
Yeah, so just on the merits of that point, look, if we're just deep in the weeds of the NLRA and you get discretion as to fact-finding, you get discretion as to remedial choice, all of that's fine. You're obviously in a very strong position. But why shouldn't we think of this case, think of that question as not having at least a First Amendment overlay to it? And even the NLRA cases describe it as an extraordinary remedy and not take lightly when you want to compel speech or compel association with speech rather than just informing the employees yourselves of your ruling.
Your Honor, if I understand, I'm understanding your question to mean a First Amendment concern in terms of an employer representative reading the remedy. Reading the notice?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. So I guess a couple of responses. First, the employer, I think, has waived any such contention because they've never raised that to this court. They've said they make their 8C and First Amendment argument with respect to the merits of the solicitation of revocation cards argument. As to that sole, you know, individual finding of a violation. But as to the remedy, that argument is waived. The employer has never said that First Amendment concerns should inform the court's determination of whether to enforce the notice reading remedy. But aside from that, this court has repeatedly enforced this remedy for the past 30-plus years. It recognized,
we have, but I didn't see in any of the cases consideration of a First Amendment issue. And I did see a lot of commentary from Judge Williams, Judge Ruth Ginsburg, and so on, making points that under current First Amendment compelled speech law would seem to support a pretty good case.
Well, I guess, yeah, Your Honor, as you pointed out, there are older decisions in which some judges have raised concerns about what they see as a level of embarrassment involved on the part of the reader of the notice. And I do think that their discussion, as you say, could be read to kind of relate to or tie to some First Amendment-related concepts. But the fact is, notwithstanding that commentary by those judges in past decisions, for 30-plus years, the court, with the knowledge of its prior precedent, has repeatedly enforced this remedy. And, you know, it has recognized that this remedy can serve to dissipate or to relieve a coercive or intimidating atmosphere created by the employer's unlawful conduct, or as the court articulated it in Federated Logistics, that this remedy can properly allow the employees to perceive that their employer, their managers are bound by the requirements of the Act and assure the employees of their rights under the Act. So this court has repeatedly recognized the proper remedial purpose of the notice reading requirement under Section 10C, and notwithstanding the prior commentary about that, you know, as mentioned, has continued to uphold this remedy. And again, I would just urge that on top of all that, that the employer has never raised this to the court.
Got it. I got it. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor. The board did, you know, act well within its extraordinary remedial discretion in light of the company's sustained and varied campaign of unlawful conduct, establishing 17 distinct violations of Section 8A3 and Section 8A1.
Could you address the issue of Ramirez as the high-level manager in the response by your friend on the other side that it would be, you know, a hyper-technical requirement for them to have raised that in their exceptions below when they made clear that they did not believe that the circumstances warranted the notice reading remedy?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for the question. I'd love to clarify that point. Their contention is meritless, and the argument is jurisdictionally barred because the only thing that the company can point to is the answering brief that it filed in response to the general counsel's exceptions to the ALJ's decision. But the ALJ's decision did not discuss Ms. Ramirez's high-level status. The ALJ did not consider or discuss anywhere in his discussion of the remedy anything about Ms. Ramirez's high-level status or about the involvement of high-level managers in the unfair labor practices. When it filed its exceptions and it said that the circumstances did not warrant the remedy, what it was talking about, if you read its answering brief, is just the nature of the violations. And it basically was saying, we agree with the judge. Well, the judge, as I just noted, the judge did not say anything about the involvement of high-level managers or about Ms. Ramirez's high-level status. So it had an opportunity
If the ALJ decision had said that the ALJ had concluded that Ms. Ramirez is not a high-level manager, and that was one of the reasons that it had given, and the exception said in Advance Pierre's exception said the exact same thing, would the issue be preserved?
Yes, if the judge said, if the judge in deciding not to recommend the remedy said Ramirez was not high level, and then Advanced PR said in the answering brief to the GC's exceptions that we agree with the judge, Ramirez was not high level, then yes, that issue, in my view, would have been adequately preserved. I think I may be over your time, Your Honor, although I frankly lost count of which chime we're on.
Well, we're on the 10-minute chime, but are there any more questions?
No, I don't have any more.
All right. Okay, then. Let's give Mr. Lindstrom 2 minutes in reply.
Thank you, Your Honor. Focusing on the second strand that Judge Katsas was asking about for our arguments, even under that strand, the Skomas case, for example, says that there should be no deference to the reasoning of the board if it doesn't explain, if it fails to consider the relevant factors. And so there's less reason for deference here to their weighing of these factors when they didn't consider why traditional remedies are not were not appropriate, so or not necessary. Also, in our brief, with regard to whether or not an extraordinary the read-aloud remedy is an extraordinary remedy, I mean, I think we tied that into First Amendment concepts because the reason it's an extraordinary remedy is because of its oppressive nature. That's why Justice Ginsburg, when she was on this court, was concerned about it. That's why members of this court have said that the public confession of sins is something you'd expect in a regime by Stalin or Mao. So there's been criticism of this extraordinary remedy, particularly because of the underlying First Amendment issues it relates to. As for Ramirez, there's been no fact-finding that she's a higher-level manager. There's certainly no fact-finding in the ALJ decision. It says on JA-71, she did not wait to bring matters to the attention of upper management, which seems to be contrasting her in the ALJ's eyes with upper management. And if you look at the findings of the board that are on footnote 4 and the surrounding pages of its opinion, it doesn't make any fact-finding about her status. It just assumes it. So I don't see any evidence in this record that shows it's upper management. And so I think that's why, it's another reason why it was an abuse of discretion on these facts to...
Isn't that another reason why you should have filed a motion for reconsideration?
Your Honor, I guess, first of all, we weren't counsel at the time. It would have been better, but I think that the objections that have been raised to this extraordinary remedy are sufficient to include the components that make up and the factors that necessarily go into it.
All right, any more questions? All right, thank you, counsel. And Madam Clerk, would you please call the next case?